Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Lou Salmonfink, Executive Director of the Cargo Systems Program Office at the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining us in our conversation is Alan Heath, Partner, Customs and Border Protection Services at IBM. Lou, how has the face of trade changed over the last 3 years, and how has that change manifested in new trade law enforcement regimes? Could you elaborate on the fundamental principles of CBP's trade strategy now and into the future?
Well, that's a good question, and in my mind, I see the following as how trade has changed. Obviously, when 9/11 hit, getting advanced electronic information, supply chain security, and so forth and so on has become imperative. It's something that we have to do, and that has been a very significant change. And in fact, the Safe Port Act that I mentioned before, Congress has mandated that the Department of Homeland Security look for even additional advanced information that we can get to ensure the safety of this country. In terms of when I hear trade strategy, it's all not just security. There are things that we have to do to make sure that, for example, the intellectual property rights or trademarks and copyrights of various U.S. companies are protected from merchandise coming in, that public health and safety is taken care of. I mean, the Food and Drug Administration and Customs helping them has a very important role to make sure that only safe things get into this country in the first place. There's a revenue to protect. We do collect duties, taxes, and fees, about $30 billion a year, so we want to make sure that that's being protected. The changes that I see in that arena are as follows. Free trade agreements. The administration is very big on free trade agreements. When free trade agreements are signed, most recently Singapore, Chile, obviously the NAFTA with Mexico and Canada and others that are in the works, that affects how we do our job. It requires the automated systems to recognize that things are coming in from countries where we're not going to be worrying about duties and fees, but it also layers in other regulations that we have to take into account. Is this stuff really coming from those countries where they're free? There's a much greater emphasis, I think, and it's greater all the time, on global cooperation from customs organizations across the world. The World Customs Organization, based in Brussels, has the mission of making sure that, to the extent possible, customs processes are harmonized across the world. If you're a trader, the ideal would be to have one packet of information that would serve as import into one country and export from another and just allow your cargo to go across the world. Many companies that are multinational meet with the WCO on a regular basis to make sure that those requirements are met. I was in Veracruz, Mexico recently meeting with some WCO representatives and also members of customs administrations across the country. And as we try to harmonize our procedures and so forth, some of the changes that I see in trade are how do you identify individuals involved in the supply chain? You know, in the United States, we rely on things like internal revenue, taxpayer IDs, and social security numbers. Well, those things don't exist in other countries, but yet we want to know who in those foreign countries is sending us or is responsible for sending things to the United States. People have suggested that ACE create a unique identification number for companies, but would other companies use that? Folks have suggested that we use third-party validators like Dun & Bradstreet or D&B, but are we going to mandate that everybody in the world go out and get a D&B number? These are tough challenges and things that we have to face as we try to bring the world closer together, as we try to bring customs administrations closer together. Another thing that we discussed while we were down there was product identification. There's a harmonized tariff code, has about 15,000 numbers in it, that everything that's imported can be broken down and understood by those codes. Well, the Food and Drug Administration has hundreds of thousands of product codes because to say medicine or aspirin isn't enough. They want to know dosage, they want to know where it was made and so forth and so on. They have a much different product code database that they use. And the reason I mention this is that as we build ACE, as we move forward, and as Customs tries to understand what's coming into the United States and if we have to look at it or if we have to get folks from other agencies to look at it before it can be released, we have to make sure that we have all the information that's necessary. So I think a change that you're going to see in trade in the future is a greater focus on trying to identify commodities using some sort of global numbering system, whatever it might be. And there are some out there that folks will tout. GS1 is one. It's nonprofit and so forth. That's going to be stuff that's going to be facing the trade community and governments across the world. And then the single window concept. We mentioned it before with ITDS. Again, when I was meeting with folks and vendors from around the world that were talking about what they could do for customs, this focus on having one packet of information that satisfies all of a country's needs. Very, very important. And it makes sense. And it's efficient. And it's something that we have to move towards. And then finally, the workforce. Our workforce is changing within customs. And as we deploy things like ACE and use other types of technology to do our jobs, the traditional role of someone sitting at a desk and getting pieces of paper in an inbox and looking at them and making decisions and maybe banging stuff in a computer screen now and then, that's going to change. They're going to be doing more analysis. They're going to be looking at trade patterns. They're going to try to understand not just transactionally but from an account basis, what is it that's coming at me here in my port today? And this particular importer, not just this one transaction, but I want to look at everything that they're doing. I want to understand better what they're doing. As far as CBP's trade strategy is concerned, we're going to continue to maintain a focus on our anti-terrorism mission. That can't go down. We're going to look for more and more ways to get additional information, to better screen that information, to use technology to ensure that what's coming into the country is safe. And on the back end, if you will, on that trade compliance end, I say we're going to use more and more of a reg audit approach. We're going to keep records. Before I mentioned in the Modernization Act, the whole business of informed compliance and telling folks that are importing, hey, or exporting, here's the rules, here's what you need to do, and you've got to keep records so that we can check on you. I think the thing that scares folks more than somebody stopping a load coming into the United States is, you know what, we're going to make sure that you've got all the records that you've that you're supposed to have, and we're going to make sure that the way you estimated duties, taxes, and fees is correct. And guess what? We've got a team of regulatory auditors that are going to visit your office next week, and they're going to spend the next month with you and really go through your books, you know, like a ton of bricks. I see that is how we're going to be focusing on making sure that the trade is compliant.
Lou, you've mentioned a couple of times the importance of securing our nation. With recognition that the war on terror is impacting the budget and priorities of all our homeland security agencies, how will the ongoing war on terror impact CBP and in particular the ACE program in the coming years?
I believe that, and I know that the department believes, otherwise they wouldn't be approving expenditure plans for us, that ACE is playing a key role in homeland security. Again, the information that we're collecting from the trade community and doing our advanced screening on is what we're collecting via our legacy system and now with Truck Manifest through ACE. It's important that that tool work, that it be efficient, that it pass that information correctly over to our targeting systems, that it receive information back and display to our officers on the line exactly what it is, if anything, that they have to be concerned about. You know, we have a program plan in place, and we hope to finish delivering this system sometime in the year 2011, all aspects of it, retooling the existing systems that we have. I can tell you that with the existing legacy system that we have, that perhaps that system was never really completed. It's still changing as it needs to. And I predict that same will happen for ACE, that when we've got that basic foundation laid, that those that are our leaders, both in Congress and in Capitol Hill, are going to demand that we do even more with that system to protect the homeland better. So I would suggest that after we finish building ACE, that we're going to continue to receive the investments that we need to make this program even better. That goes back to us being able to demonstrate that there's real business value, not just to the trade community, hey, you're saving money, this and that, but also to the government, that there's a real tangible benefit to having ACE in place and to allow that information to be to the people that need to have it when they've got to have it.
Lou, given your statements about the importance of ACE and given the breadth and technical complexity of ACE, would you elaborate on your ACE workforce strategy? And what steps are you taking to attract and maintain a high-quality technical and professional workforce?
We have really two groups of folks working on this as a team. We have our government team and we have our contractor team. And that's been a successful model for us in the existing system that we have, our ACS or legacy system, and we're using that in ACE as well. And so I would cite kind of our contract oversight. Certainly, you know, we've looked at the team that we're working with right now to bring properly skilled people to the table as we develop task orders and as we develop work products that we have to achieve. My team sits down with the contractor team and looks at the specific skill sets that are coming to the table. I've been tracking things like contractor turnover, as you know very well, our individuals that we've attracted to the program staying in place. I've made it my personal mission to meet with everybody that's working on the project so that I can sit down and tell them, you know, you're down into this particular part of the system, you're testing, you're writing code, you're doing development activities, you're doing outreach activities, you're managing the money. Like the conversation we're having here today, let's take the blinders off for a minute and look across the program, and I'm trying to let folks understand how what they're doing in terms of their technical expertise is actually making the country safer. Truck Manifest, again, a good one. The government work workforce. As we're moving from one technology to another, a lot of folks have expressed concern and angst, if you will, over, well, you know, what's the future for me here? I mean, I know these types of technologies, but clearly those are going away. We're going to turn ACS off. We're going to be in a new platform. And we're working with them to make sure that there's proper training opportunities available so that they can improve their skills and stay with us on the program. At the end of the day, it goes back to the point I made earlier. I think that this is a team effort. The integration has to come from both sides. The contracting side has to rely upon the government to give clear direction, consistent direction, and at the same time, the government side needs to make sure that the contracting folks that are working on this are working as one and that there's not stovepipes over there going in different directions.
Lou, you've had a very successful career and just a tremendous amount of passion for the mission and public service. I'm curious, what advice would you give to someone who may be out there thinking about starting a career in public service?
That's a tough question, and I think, you know, my opinion, you know, others are going to certainly see it their own way. You know, I'm nearing the end of my federal career, and it's hard to believe that it's been almost 30 years. And when I think back to, you know, working on the border and doing that mission for almost a decade and then coming into headquarters and working a variety of different jobs, I would tell you that it's been very fulfilling. As I think about moving on and retirement and all the things that holds, it's with a certain amount of, sorrow that I look back and think that this thing is over. You know, it's not just a job where you're making dollars for a corporation, and I've done a lot of things before I came with the government. I was a salesman. I worked in a machine shop making stuff, and those jobs have their own thing. When 9/11 happened, and I was over at the Department of Treasury, and it was a great job. I enjoyed what I was doing over there, but I look back at Customs where I was, and I realized that that frontline organization was really going to have this heavy lift and what it had to accomplish and this challenges that it has every day. And a lot of us that had drifted off and gone into different organizations came back to Customs, came back to work there because of this sense of mission. It would be wrong for me to sit here and say that, yep, that's it. We can protect this country and there's absolutely no risk whatsoever to everything coming in. I mean, we live in a free country. But I can tell you for a fact that all the things that we've been doing and continue to do have made the country much safer than it is. You know, I don't envy, the Secretary of Homeland Security's job, my commissioner's job, the president's job and all of this. But being part of, I hope, the solution to really do what's important for the country has been very important for me. So I would encourage people to look at government service. There's job fairs that you'll see. I think the Department of Homeland Security recently had one, and I know they'll have more. I know Customs did. I would encourage anybody out there to at least consider a career in the federal service, to look at what it has to offer, and to consider it. It's very rewarding.
That's wonderful advice and a great perspective. Unfortunately, we have reached the top of our hour, and we're out of time. I want to thank you for fitting us into your busy schedule, but more importantly, Alan and I would like to thank you personally for your dedicated service to our country in securing and facilitating trade to and from the United States.
Well, hey, thanks a lot to both of you for bringing us on here. It's great to talk about the program and so forth. And I guess my final thing to the world out there would be if you want to learn more about ACE, because we really just scratched the surface here, or about the Customs mission, I think the best place to go is on our website, cbpcharliebravopapa.gov. If you go on there, there's tons of information about our mission, how we've evolved, about ACE modernization, the programs I mentioned before, CTPAT, other programs that we have, about who's leading the agency right now. You can also link over to the Department of Homeland Security site from there. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in careers or interested in more information about these topics, to use that as a resource.
That's great. This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Lou Samenfink, Executive Director of the Cargo Systems Program Office at the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. My co-host has been Alan Heath, partner in IBM's Customs and Border Protection Services Group. As you enjoy the rest of your day, please take time to remember the men and women of our armed and civil services abroad who can't hear this morning's show on how we're improving their government, but who deserve our unconditional respect and support. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Albert Morales. Thank you for listening.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.